Before we begin with our second case, I'd just like to welcome Senior Judge Stuckey back to the bench.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Senior Judge Stuckey, does it feel interesting to have your portrait staring down at you as you sit here today?
Indeed.
The next case is United States v. Bench. Captain Flazar, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Patera, are
you yes, Your
prepared
Honor.
To argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Captain Alex Flazar, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellant in this case, Master Sergeant Daniel Bench. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I request to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
The senior prosecutor in this case lied to 9-year-old EC, telling him that his father, the accused, was not present at the general court-martial at which he was testifying. Lying to a witness before a tribunal is plain and obvious error in and of itself, but the prosecutor's affirmative lie went beyond even that. It struck directly at the heart of my client's right to confront the witness against him. The success of this lie was exacerbated by the prosecutor's reassurances that EC was only speaking with three people and that those three people would not share his statements with anyone else.
Counsel, I've been gone a year and I find myself exactly back where I used to be, which is all this weird exchange took place and defense counsel sacked. Why isn't this waived?
Your Honor, for two reasons. First, there's no waiver by operation of law under an RCM 905 based on stare decisis. And second, as the government concedes there was no affirmative waiver, they're left to argue.
No, it's either forfeiture or it's waiver. It's forfeiture by silence if it's not waiver. But go ahead.
Your Honor, in terms of the forfeiture the implied forfeiture or implied waiver. In this case, the record does not establish or clearly establish an intent to relinquish a constitutional right. Under this court's...
Well, is this a constitutional issue?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. This struck directly at the heart of my client's right to...
So the burden's on the government we get to prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. If we reach prejudice, the burden is on the government to establish harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, based on the remaining evidence under Dalton and Coy.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry I broke into you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll break in anyway. But before you go on, the first issue I think as Senior Judge Stuckey has touched on is whether or not you have a constitutional issue. In other words, is the Sixth Amendment implicated in this case? And we all know and agree that the Confrontation Clause guarantees an opportunity to cross-examine. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I did read your brief, but it's not clear to me how what the complaint is about something that the trial counsel did during the direct examination of a government witness. And so it's not clear to me how that affected the opportunity for cross-examination because defense counsel quickly began cross-examination after all of this.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the cross-examination did follow the senior prosecutor's affirmative lies, which essentially rendered EC the anathema anonymous accuser, as Justin Harlan discusses in California versus Green. Here, having been affirmatively told that he was only speaking with three people and that his testimony would not be shared, he is free, in effect, to fabricate, and the inconsistencies and fabrications you can see throughout the record, discussed more in depth in appellant's brief at 38 to 43.
Is his testimony littered with that kind of inconsistency because he was an 8-year-old autistic child, or is it because he knew and was plotting now in his 8-year-old autistic mind that he can now fabricate now that his father is not aware of his secret?
Your Honor, EC's testimony, in fact, reveals at JA-155 that he was afraid of appellant finding out, and that is why it is the prosecutor's lie that rendered him essentially outside of an adversarial hearing in which he could tell anybody anything.
Right, but what you're suggesting is that having been told his father is now not there, not watching him, disclose his secret, that he is now free to fabricate. But wouldn't it, can it operate just the opposite?
Your Honor, though there are studies in some cases that it could potentially increase the reliability, that is still not what the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation affords. And we can see this in the tension between Coy, the remaining of modern Sixth Amendment jurisprudence in terms of Crawford on, and Craig. The Sixth Amendment affords the right to confront the witness against them personally. Craig provided a very narrow, expressly limited exception. And as this court has recognized previously in Dalton, procedures that fall outside of Craig's narrow limitations do not comport with the Sixth Amendment violation.
Well, you're not quarreling with the procedure, the one-way the VTC testimony.
Correct, Your Honor. It is not the remote testimony in this case that is the error, but it is the prosecutor's affirmative lies that are the error in this case. EC walks into his testimony at least with some degree of minimal understanding that there is a hearing going on and that appellant was going to be present. He asks, are the court there to hear us and whether the court is going on? The prosecutor's affirmative lie, stating that he's only speaking to three people and that they will not share his testimony, removes that away.
And if this momentous issue arose and defense counsel was in the room with the child, was he not?
Yes, Your Honor, he was.
And I guess my question is this can't really be a case where counsel's just sitting on his or her hands, or, you know, a lot going on at a trial, things get by you. This seems to be pretty evident as to what the trial counsel told the child while the defense counsel was there in the room. And you've not indicated with an allegation of ineffectiveness that counsel was less than competent.
Your Honor, in this case, appellant would submit that EC's testimony was, in fact, both physically and mentally frenetic. You can see that in the record at JA-148, JA-164, and as even the prosecutor admits, it was difficult to track, even for the military justice, and that's in the record.
What's that got to do with the price of wheat? He's frenetic. He's also, sounds like a pretty sharp kid. He says, why is that thing covered? He said, you know, who's in there? You know, CTC had all kinds of problems with him, and it wasn't because he was dumb. The only person who was dumb there was CDC, and I'm talking about dumb in the sense of silent, not dumb in the sense of stupid.
Yes, Your Honor.
To me, you're doing exactly what the government has all kinds of woulda, coulda, shoulda explanations about why defense counsel did what he did, and frankly, I'm not interested in them, but I am interested in why you think why this isn't waived.
Your Honor, because the record does not establish a clear intent to relinquish a constitutional right under Jones, my apologies, Your Honor. In this case, we start with the presumption against constitutional waiver. And
I'm not convinced it's constitutional, but go ahead.
Your Honor, after the presumption against the constitutional waiver, the record must clearly establish an intent to relinquish. Again, EC's testimony was frenetic, but more than that, the government's argument that there was residual hearsay that affected the defense's case is unavailing here, specifically because the CDC...
Can I go back to your issue or statement about how frenetic the child's testimony was?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just so I understand what you're saying, are you saying that the child's testimony was so frenetic that defense counsel didn't acknowledge or couldn't understand what had happened during the direct examination?
Your Honor, it is the backdrop on which the direct examination occurs and on which the CDC's lack of objection occurs. Yes, the prosecutor in this case even noted on the record it would be hard for the military judge to track along with the CDC at the record at 364. During EC's testimony, the counsel had to touch their noses in order to gain EC's attention, and at the JA at 164 and 148, you see that EC is, in fact, walking back and forth across the room.
But the record also says that defense counsel is apparently taking copious notes during the direct examination.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, amidst the presumption against the constitutional waiver and this frenetic testimony, it does not establish a clear intent to relinquish a constitutional right to confront the witness.
Okay, I didn't mean to knock you off track, but you were getting ready to talk about the government's suggestion that there was a tactical reason here because of the outstanding residual hearsay.
The residual hearsay, yes, Your Honor. And with respect to this, the record does make clear that the residual hearsay carried no import on the defense case. First, the CDC argues at JA 328 that the residual hearsay did not depend on EC's taking the stand. Further, the residual hearsay, in fact, would have actually helped the defense's case, because if you look at the defense's opening, statements coming from EC's mother or her best friend played right into the defense's theme and theory of the case that this allegation was, in fact, coaxed or coerced. So this would have put the defense in a better position without additional statements that EC rendered in his testimony. So here the government relies on the mere existence of residual hearsay in order to attempt to establish a clear intent at relinquishing a right, and the record simply does not support that. This is particularly so when you compare this case with the cases that this court relied on in United States versus Harcrow, 66 MJ 154, in developing the strategy standard. In Harcrow, each of those cases involved counsel stipulating to testimony. In Plitman, in particular, 193 F3rd, Second Circuit case, Plitman was in pretrial conferences where the stipulation was being discussed along with the advantages that could be gained by stipulating. Here, we have no stipulation, and in fact, the record shows that immediately after trial, if there even was any strategy, my client dissented because this issue was raised in clemency at JA 306.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but let's assume we're working under a plain error standard here and it is forfeiture. The essence of your case, as I understand it, is that the Confrontation Clause requires that the witness, when they're testifying, understand that to the extent they're accusing the defendant, that the defendant is going to hear those accusations. And that here, EC was under the false belief that the defendant wouldn't. So I think that's a completely reasonable argument to make about the Confrontation Clause, but if we're working under plain error, that seems to be an open question both in this court's precedent and the Supreme Court's precedent. So how, under a plain error standard, would we agree with you that for EC to testify under the false belief that the defendant wouldn't hear the accusation, that that was an error?
Your Honor, I do want to note that appellant's assignment of error is not that EC wasn't told that he wasn't there. It is that the prosecutor affirmatively lied. That is the error in this case. And there is precedent to state that where the procedures used to secure testimony fall outside of Craig, then they do not comport with the Sixth Amendment. That's this court's decision at Dalton, 45 MJ212. There is absolutely both rules and precedent that prevent a prosecutor from lying in court. And it is those rules and this prosecutorial misconduct that render it plain error. The question is then, as Your Honor noted, whether this is a constitutional right, and unequivocally it is.
Counsel, and then I'll one more thing and then I'll shut up. Is the Confrontation Clause here kind of a will-o'-the-wisp? In other words, do we need to shove this situation into the box of confrontation, or is it enough that there was significant prosecutorial misconduct based on committed with the purpose of eliciting testimony from a government witness who was a child on the autism spectrum?
Certainly, Your Honor, under either plain error standard, FRCP 52, if this court decided that Greer applied, or Article 59, either way, appellant has met his burden here because, as the record demonstrates, but for the prosecutor's lies, EC in all likelihood would not have testified or would have testified very differently.
Counsel, how do you reach that conclusion that we know what would have happened if without this lie?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, because the record demonstrates that prior to the lies, EC twice tried to leave the room before he was able to provide his testimony. And second, he only provided oath and affirmation on page 155 after, and Your Honor, I see my time has elapsed, if I may conclude. He only provided oath and affirmation after being told that appellant was no longer present.
Does it matter, though, counsel, that the trier of fact here saw all of this? They saw the prevarication by trial counsel. They saw the demeanor and the less than linear testimony of the child victim. Doesn't it matter that they could see all this play out?
Your Honor, it does matter, but not for precisely the reason, if I understand your question correctly, that you're saying, because EC's autism here does in fact play a part with respect to that demeanor. The member panel had an entire other reason where normally they could evaluate demeanor for evasiveness or fabrication. They had an entire other reason why they could attribute that. And so,
but that would be true if the child was testifying in court.
Your Honor, it would have, but what Craig says is that all remaining reliability has to be guaranteed, and here all reliability was destroyed by the lies and the remaining confrontation pillars.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major John Patera, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Naomi Dennis, I represent the United States. When a vulnerable child is permitted to provide one-way remote testimony, the Confrontation Clause does not require their awareness that their abuser is present and observing them on the other end of the screen. No authority has ever established this alleged constitutional mandate. So even if the trial counsel misrepresented the circumstances of appellant's appearance in the courtroom, it violated no constitutional right. Instead, consistent with the Confrontation Clause, EC was produced for live testimony, he was placed under oath, and he was subject to unrestricted and unimpeded cross-examination that was observable by both the appellant and the fact finder in this case. This was constitutionally permissible.
Counsel, can you just elaborate on your reasoning here? It sounds like you're directly addressing the question that Judge Hardy asked counsel for the appellant, which is there a precedent establishing that the victim has to know, the witness has to know that the accused is watching? And I understood appellant to say, well, that's not our claim. We're not saying specifically that. We're saying that you can't lie in order to achieve that testimony. And you're basically saying, well, because you don't have that right, it doesn't matter if you lie. Is that your logic?
Yes, Your Honor. At bottom, if there's no underlying constitutional right, a professional responsibility issue involving trial counsel doesn't impact or implicate it. And so that's important.
So you're saying that there might be an ethical violation, but that doesn't mean there's a confrontation clause violation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what do we make of the Supreme Court, Corey versus Iowa, where they said, quote, it is always more difficult to tell a lie about a person to his face than behind his back. Doesn't that go to the heart of confrontation?
Your Honor, that is certainly, Justice Scalia's observation in Coy v. Iowa is certainly getting at a virtue of face-to-face confrontation. And to be clear, face-to-face confrontation is one of the essential elements of confrontation talked about by the Supreme Court. It's one of four. But in this context, when we're talking about one-way remote testimony, by design, face-to-face confrontation will never happen. And this actually gets to Judge Stuckey's question about...
But that's a separate issue in terms of the Supreme Court has blessed this idea of using VTC in terms of face-to-face confrontation as compared to the point that's being made here in Coy versus Iowa. If you believe that you're speaking and that this person about whom you're speaking will never learn of it, as the Supreme Court's noting, it can be easier to lie behind their back as compared to their face. So why isn't that a significant aspect of the confrontation clause?
Your Honor, because it's part and parcel of the right to face-to-face confrontation. And that right has been extinguished in this case when appellant did not object in any way, shape, or form to the motion for remote testimony before trial. And then when it came time for actually ruling, the military judge ruling on the opportunity for one-way remote.
Now, wait a minute. You're sliding over into a different argument here. Please focus on the question I'm asking you. And that is, it's not the VTC issue in terms of face-to-face confrontation. It's this idea that trial counsel has told this victim witness, there's the person who you say did this to you is not going to find out about this. And the Supreme Court is saying in the confrontation context, it's easier to lie if you're doing it behind someone's back rather than to their face. That's the issue I'd like you to address.
Your Honor, there may be some truth to the notion in the context of face-to-face confrontation that it may be more difficult to tell a lie behind someone's back than it is to their face. The government doesn't contest Justice Scalia's observation in that case. But the Supreme Court 2 years later in Maryland v. Craig also observed that the presence of the accused, case in point during face-to-face confrontation, could actually undermine the truth-seeking function of the Confrontation Clause. It could impede a vulnerable victim, as in this case, from being able to communicate their testimony to the fact finder. It could also cause trauma. And that's what these procedures of one-way remote testimony are designed to do. They're to mitigate trauma.
Well, again, you're talking about that. We're not talking about the VTC issue. That's been blessed. That's fine. The focus is on, I'll use the term prevarication, by the trial counsel here, where he falsely led the victim witness to believe that the person against whom he's making these allegations is never going to learn about it.
And, Your Honor, I apologize. I might not be understanding the distinction. I am attempting to answer your question. But the right to face-to-face confrontation, when the witness or vulnerable victim is produced, they would be aware of the accused's presence. By design, when we're talking about one-way remote testimony, we're not talking about face-to-face confrontation. And so this court, in the context of plain error review, as Judge Hardy indicated, would have to announce that an accused not just has a constitutional right to be present in the courtroom, to observe the demeanor of this witness, but to have this witness be subjectively aware that that the criminal defendant is observing them and their testimony. And no authority has ever established that right, and that's critical in the context of plain error review.
Well, it sounds like, is the government's position, now it wouldn't happen in this case because of the nature of the question of the lie told, but are you saying that prosecutorial misconduct is okay in a remote situation that wouldn't be okay in straight face-to-face court?
Your Honor, the government does not seek this court to bless misrepresenting any facts to a witness in this case. That's not the government's position.
We're not here to bless it. We're here to determine you know, how this case comes out.
Yes, Your Honor. But in the context of the distinction I believe Your Honor is drawing is between, okay, is it okay if the witness is testifying under the circumstances that we see day in and day out in courts martial where the witness is produced and appears in court, vice one-way remote testimony. The government's position is consistent with United States v. Meek, is that any prosecutorial misconduct, if this court were to find it, would have to actually impact a constitutional right. And so in this circumstance, based upon these facts, the misrepresentation from the trial counsel.
You agree with the appellant that the standard here is the constitutional one?
No, Your Honor. The government does not.
Yeah, I mean, where's the burden?
Your Honor, I'm consistent with, as you allude to, whether it's a constitutional issue or not, but also the Supreme Court's opinion, United States v. Greer, whether it be any of those circumstances, the government believes that appellant has the burden of ordinary plain error.
Okay, because you just said something that sounded like it was the reverse.
I apologize if okay. I did. I misspoke.
Go ahead.
Major Patera, before you continue on, can you help me out a little bit about how this setup works in this particular case? Now, my understanding is that there are two screens in the room where the child is, and one has a cover over the screen, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a VTC, and not clear who did it, but someone placed a piece of paper over the screen in the remote location.
All right, so there's only one screen.
That I don't know. It's not clear from the record. Okay. I might be applying personal knowledge at that point.
Understand. Now, when they put the cover over the screen for the child victim to testify, what is the purpose of covering the screen?
Your Honor, the stated purpose in the government's motion for remote testimony, and actually during the colloquy, once the witness had become distracted by several different things in the room, to include a fidget and the screen itself, was to help this child witness focus. The child required a sterile environment and was easily distracted, so that was the purpose.
Right, but doesn't it also, it seems like it's intended to give the child victim witness the impression that there is no one watching him or her.
Your Honor, I'm not certain I agree with that. I mean, there is the potential. I don't know if the record bears that out in this particular case, nor do I think that would necessarily be constitutionally impermissible. In Maryland v. Craig, that was one-way remote testimony, which would have served the purpose by design that you allude to there, Your Honor.
I see. Okay.
So I want to begin by talking about waiver, specifically rule-based waiver. So RCM 905E states that any motions, requests, defenses or objections other than lack of jurisdiction or failure to state an offense must be raised before the court-martial is adjourned. Failure to do so, quote, shall constitute waiver, end quote. Does not say forfeit, does not say forfeit absent plain error, or waive absent plain error. Now, to be certain, an appellant identifies these in these cases in the reply brief, this court has been reluctant or declined to apply the plain language of that rule in certain circumstances. So in United States v. Treat, the defense had contested the factual issue during their closing argument that led to a constitutional claim of fatal variance. United States v. Jones, the court could not discern a reasonable tactical reason for not objecting to some hearsay but not others. And in Sweeney, there was no colorable objection to the testimonial hearsay that was admitted at trial because the colorable objection arose after trial. But none of those circumstances apply in this case. Appellant did not contest the one-way remote testimony at any point, either before or during trial, consistent with that's in stark contrast to Treat. Appellant also didn't contest trial counsel's comment until actually coming before this court. So it did not contest a comment made during the oath colloquy by trial counsel during that colloquy, later on during the direct examination, at any point during the cross-examination where they simply could have corrected the misunderstanding or cross-examined EC on his underlying concern about appellant hearing his testimony. Didn't raise it until the clemency submission, but even then, didn't raise it before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. It appeared for the first time in substance before this court.
So instead of distinguishing other cases from this one, can you point to any case law that would support your assertion in your brief that there was waiver here because, quote, appellant had ample opportunity and a plain and obvious basis to object? Can you cite to the case law that supports that as meaning it has to be waiver?
Your Honor, not to that it has to be waived, but I can point to a counterfactual, which is United States v. Jones.
And I'm asking you for a specific case. I specifically said I'm not looking for you to distinguish. I'm asking you for specific support for your assertion in your brief.
Your Honor, I don't have a case from this court that specifically answers that, but I would direct this court to the plain language of RCM 905E that says it shall constitute waiver, and especially in the context of the constitutional claim here, which was the right to face-to-face confrontation and the related subjective awareness that a witness might have that flows from that right to face-to-face confrontation.
Counsel, just even from a, I know you don't have a case, but even from a first principles standpoint, what authority would the President have to promulgate a rule that waives by operation of law a defendant's constitutional right?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Hemphill recently observed that jurisdictions have the authority to enact reasonable rules governing the assertion of a constitutional right. And so, well, I don't know if I'm...
I mean, that's a jurisdictional question, right? But is that the best example that we have in a situation where Congress could give the President the statutory authority to waive by operation of law a defendant's constitutional rights?
Your Honor, I believe Congress could, and that reading RCM 905E in this way would be reasonable. But the as far as first principles, that's perhaps where I'm not understanding the court's question. I'd like to address it quickly or more directly. So could you restate the question? I'm sorry.
What is the best authority you could cite for the President's authority to, by rule, waive a defendant's constitutional right?
Your Honor, the best authority that I could cite is the, as I previously articulated, Hemphill v. New York, which the Supreme Court recognized the authority, though I don't believe they articulated the first principles or underlying authority for doing so, as well as, and I can provide a supplemental citation to the court after this hearing, that an accused is not entitled to a particular standard of review on appeal. I think whether the President could articulate or provide a rule that requires for waiver or forfeiture ultimately gets to how this court would review it on appeal. And so,
Counselor, can I ask you, I want to make sure where there are playing the gaps here. It apparently is not your position that in terms of confrontation clause, the Supreme Court has identified certain key elements, things such as physical presence, oath, cross-examination, observation of demeanor. And therefore, here we look at these facts and say, none of those crucial elements are implicated here. The trial counsel's prevarication did not affect those key elements. That seems to be a solid argument for the government's position, but you don't seem to be making that argument. What am I missing here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the government, perhaps not, maybe I'm not articulating myself before this court, but in our written brief did attempt to articulate that the underlying right, as discussed in Maryland v. Craig and other cases identified in the various pleadings before the court, include the right to have the witness be placed under oath, the right to a full opportunity for cross-examination, and the right for observation, both of the accused and the fact finder, all the other court participants who can observe the witness's demeanor and judge their credibility for themselves.
And so that is your argument.
Yes.
And that nothing that the trial counsel here did changed those key elements.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that's how you prevail.
And that's one of the ways that we could prevail. I think there's three paths that this court could go down for the government to affirm the finding of the sentence and for the government to win. The first would be waiver, as I've talked about, either by operation of law under RCM 905E or as a factual matter based upon the defense's failure to contest this in any way, shape, or form before the court martial adjourned. Alternatively, as Your Honor indicated, it's the essential rights to confrontation and how that rigorous adversarial testing still happened in this case, in that EC was produced for live testimony, he was placed under oath, and appellant had every opportunity to cross-examine him and address any and all issues that have been raised on appeal about his reliability, about his subjective concerns about appellant hearing his testimony. EC was there at trial and available to be cross-examined on these things. And then alternatively, applying ordinary plain error and holding appellant to his burden, consistent with the Greer. So,
counsel, on that last point, at the very end of counsel for appellant's argument, counsel for appellant said, well, but we can meet that test because if they had told him a lie, he wouldn't have testified and the outcome of the case would have been different. What's the government's response to that?
Your Honor, I think that's a speculative point, not completely unsupported by the record, to be clear, but a speculative point nonetheless. EC, the bottom line, is even though EC expressed these concerns and it was part and parcel of the justification for one-way remote testimony, he appeared at trial and he testified. And he was placed, he was cross-examined by appellant's lead attorney and stood firm and provided his testimony to the fact finder. So the notion that if this was, if this error never occurred or if the circuit defense counsel had simply corrected it during cross-examination or the military judge at some point before adjournment that EC would not have testified, I think that's too speculative under a plain error standard review to carry his burden. Moreover, in Greer, the recent Supreme Court opinion, the court made clear that it was appropriate when assessing a non-structural constitutional claim, a forfeited non-structural constitutional claim, that it was appropriate to look outside the record, not just at the trial transcript. And here, that's where you have the various pretrial statements made by EC that were potentially admissible as residual hearsay, and then informed their tactical decisions and thus informs whether there's a discernible reason for finding waiver in the record.
What do we make of the dispute about whether those hearsay statements would have been admissible or whether their admissibility would have depended on EC's unavailability, since that's not determined in the record? If we were to address that, would we have to decide the admissibility question?
No, Your Honor, I don't think you have to decide the admissibility question because ultimately the arguments that appellant has articulated on appeal for why they would not have been admissible were not made before a trial judge, so we don't know whether they would or would not have come in. The military judge would have had considerable discretion in determining what evidence met those criteria. It instead informed the tactical decisions and in turn this court's evaluation of whether waiver occurred based upon whether that information was potentially available and factored into EC or the defense's desire to have EC on the witness stand. That, coupled with some of the other representations and facts bared out in the trial record, reinforced the notion that this was, in fact, an intentional decision to keep EC on the witness stand. So beginning with not opposing the request for one-way remote testimony, continuing on to not objecting to the misrepresentation from trial counsel despite a plain and obvious basis for doing so, and then not attacking it in any way, shape, or form, but still successfully cross-examining EC on his inconsistent statements at trial and being able to successfully discuss his demeanor during closing argument and secure an acquittal on it. He made those decisions at trial, and those decisions have consequences, and requiring the government to not only overcome the rebuttable presumption of against waiver of constitutional error, but then still holding the government to the burden of proving harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, becomes unworkable, especially in light of some of the reasons articulated in the dissent in Tovas-Charas. I see my time has expired, so barring any further questions.
So it's the government's position that, whether it's prevarication or lying, that eliciting testimony in this fashion is okay as long as the formalities of Confrontation Clause jurisprudence are complied with.
Your Honor, I wouldn't suggest
that. It seemed to be what you're saying. Well, he was sworn. Well, he as long as those formalities are complied with, the fact that he lied doesn't matter.
Your Honor, it may create, I don't want to say it's okay because it certainly creates
the potential I'm not talking ethics here and I'm not the bar exam.
Certainly, Your Honor. And all I'm attempting to assert is that for the purpose of the Confrontation Clause, if those key elements that you referred to are complied with, then any potential professional responsibility issue does not implicate the Constitution, the Confrontation Clause.
Okay, then I'm right. What you're saying, the government's position is that as long as the formalities are complied with, the rest is irrelevant.
Yes,
irrelevant in this sense, in this context.
In this context, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, it appears to be the government's position that an anonymous accuser in this case is fine. Ethics notwithstanding, a prosecutor can falsely tell a witness that not only is the appellant not present at the proceedings, but that his testimony will not be heard by anyone else. In other words, he is the anonymous accuser, and that rendering of him as the anonymous accuser cuts directly against the efficacy of the cross-examination in this case.
I understand your point, but I don't understand your use of the phrase anonymous accuser. Everybody did have an opportunity to see who the witness was. Not only the triers of fact, the members of the general court-martial, but also the accused. So why do you use the phrase anonymous accuser?
EC was led to believe by the prosecutor that his testimony would never be shared by anyone, allowing him to be veiled and cloaked within the secrecy of
the So in his people. Mind, he was an anonymous accuser.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is what undercuts the efficacy of cross-examination in this case. From Maddox to...
You're going back to, Coy versus Iowa, where they're saying, hey, if you in your mind are an anonymous accuser, you may lie, you may gild the lily in terms of the testimony you give. So you're going back to that.
Yes, Your Honor, that is one point. But cross-examination and confrontation have been separate and distinct even from Maddox, which stated the substance of the constitutional protection is preserved once the witness had had the opportunity of seeing face-to-face and of subjecting him to the ordeal of cross-examination. Coy recognizes that the efficacy of cross-examination depends on the adversarial setting and the witness's understanding that he is providing testimony face-to-face.
Counsel, on that point, can I go back to the line of questioning that Judge Sparks was asking counsel for the government about? Let's suppose, and this is not the facts, but let's suppose the trial counsel had not made a false statement. But the trial counsel, and again, this is not supported by the record, but the trial counsel had put the piece of paper on the video monitor. And again, this is not the record, but if you ask the trial counsel, why did you put the paper on the video monitor, the answer would be, because I didn't want the victim to see what was going on in the courtroom. Wouldn't that be the exact same thing here?
Your Honor.
I mean, wouldn't that, if your claim is that you can't prevent the victim from knowing that he's being watched, doesn't that make one-way video impossible?
No, Your Honor, because in other circumstances, oath and cross-examination and the adversarial setting of the hearing all typically afford those constitutional protections. Here, they did not. Because, as Coy said, it is always harder to tell a lie to someone's face than behind their back.
That's the point of putting the piece of paper up. Isn't the same thing, the piece of paper up? Now he doesn't know that they're watching.
One-way remote testimony, Your Honor, in this case is not the error. But for the prosecutor's lies, what would have been on the record
is... Put aside the prosecutor's lies, and the only thing he did is put the piece of paper up. And because he put the piece of paper up, he didn't know that other people could see him. I'm worried that if we accept your view, I'm worried that if we accept your view, then we logically have to go to the point that we can't do one-way video.
No, Your Honor, that is not the case. And take out the prosecutor's lies in this case, allow for a screen, and Your Honor, I see my time has elapsed, if I may conclude. Allow for the screen being covered. What the evidence in this case would have shown is that EC walked in and said, some people in there, and is appellant going to be standing right next to them? But for the lies, that would have been the record in this case, and those lies affirmatively led him away from that. That is the error. There is no error with remote testimony that was duly authorized in this case. Lies were not.
So to build on the questions that were posed by Judge Max and the distinction you're drawing, so then let's say at some point during this, the child victim said something along the lines of, so when am I going to court, and so forth. So what if you had a situation where there were no affirmative steps on the part of the trial counsel to obscure that fact? There was no piece of paper, there were no lies. But at the end of the testimony, as the child is getting off screen, says, now when am I going to be testifying in court? Obviously, if a person were in a courtroom, they would know that the person they're accusing is in front of them. So how does this implicate the Confrontation Clause?
Your Honor, with respect specifically to your hypothetical, that would not necessarily implicate the Confrontation Clause. Again, it is those affirmative lies that undercut the adversarial hearing. The witness's subjective knowledge is not a requirement, and no new rules must be established from this case. Prosecutors can't lie, and the Sixth Amendment confrontation right must be afforded. Anything outside of Craig is violative, as this court, recognized in this principle in Dalton. And with respect, Your Honor, to the burden, if I may address that briefly, under Tovar Chavez, the overwhelming weight of this court's precedent state that the government maintains the burden to prove harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I see your time has expired. You're getting on to another point. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.